WNUR News. I'm Gabe Shumway. You're listening to the 6 o'clock news on WNUR 89.3 FM, HD1, Evanston, Chicago. It's Monday, November 4th, 2024. Tonight on WNUR News, a look inside Halloween festivities on campus, a look back on one of this year's Halloween movies, the tornado alarm test, and this week's B-list. Those stories and more tonight on WNUR News at 6. Thanks for swinging by. Around the world, spooky season is now starting to wrap up. Ingrid Smith explores the best costumes and festivities on campus this season.
This Halloween fell on a Thursday, giving students an opportunity to get spooky and celebrate in the middle of midterms. From pumpkin carving to costume contests, Northwestern students had countless opportunities to get in the Halloween spirit. Communication freshman Tallulah Sarig spent her Halloween working in the haunted house in the Lewis Room at Norris. The Northwestern Theme Park Engineering Design Group designed the house. Inside, a small cast of actors performed jump scares, creepy songs, and everything in between. After hearing about the haunted house open call through a flyer at Norris, Sarig used her acting skills to bring nightmares to life.
I played a creepy mother rocking a zombie baby that had spiders crawling into its mouth. And this zombie baby was bought at Spirit Halloween. And there was a tag on it when we got it that said Spider Biter Billy. So in the haunted house, when people walked in, I would say, "Have you met Billy?" Like, I just named him Billy as a result.
Sarig said the haunted house was pitch black, and visitors held flashlights so they could see her. The catch was, she couldn't see them.
I think the funniest part was when someone I know would come into the house. I remember one of the earlier groups, someone comes in, and I'm like, "Hi, have you met Billy?" And she's like, "I know you!" And I still don't know who she was. So if you said, "I know you," in the house, and you're hearing this, call me.
For Sarig, the haunted house was an opportunity to explore a more immersive form of theatrical art than she was used to. Next year, she is interested in helping produce the event.
I kind of got to take a look at like a different type of theater. Like, I think that maybe before doing this house, I didn't totally see or comprehend haunted houses and stuff like that as like a form of theater. And I think it kind of opened my eyes to like, oh, theater can be other things.
Communication freshman Sasha Durda also viewed Halloween as a chance to let her creativity out. Durda created 4 costumes that she wore to various parties and events around campus. She was a skeleton, Cher from Clueless, Edgar Allan Poe reimagined, and a yogi bear. Durda's yogi bear costume was not representative of the character, but of a bear that does yoga.
I really like doing puns and wordplay in my costumes. Like, I'm from New Orleans, and so we dress up a lot, not just for Halloween, but for Mardi Gras as well. And so my whole family gets into it. You know, like last year, we were Dolly Parton, Salvador Dali, and a furniture Dolly, aka Dollywood. And then before that, my mom and I were Napoleon Dynamite and Napoleon Bonaparte. It's kind of a tradition, and I just wanted to carry it on my first year in college.
For Durda, Halloween was an opportunity to go all out on costumes. She did elaborate face paint, experimented with her hair, and bought costume materials from local shops.
With Yogi Bear, I went down to Crossroads in Evanston, the thrift shop, and I found this great brown wool jacket. So that was kind of like the main fur. And then I got bear ears and the like fur gloves that make it look like my hands are furry too. And then I gave myself some face paint, a cute little like nose and everything, and then wore sports bra and yoga pants, basically.
On Halloween night, Weinberg Jr. and resident assistant Dave Arthur hosted a trick-or-treat event with 13 other RAs in the Southwest area. Students traveled to different dorms and knocked on RAs' doors to receive a piece of candy, an apple, or an orange. Arthur, who dressed up as one of his RA friends, said Halloween festivities help relieve students' stress.
I think it can be special because like everyone here is so stressed with classes, especially like first year students adjusting to college with their like first round of midterms at that time. Like Halloween generally happens week 5, week 6. I think whereas in other schools who may not have as rigorous classes and have more of a party atmosphere, it's like just another night. But for us, it's something more unique because it's kind of a shared break in a stressful quarter.
For WNUR News, I'm Ingrid Smith.
Now, diving headlong into the world of arts and entertainment. Lisa Frankenstein entered theaters earlier this year in time for Valentine's Day. But is it bad enough to be good? Max Milo has everything you need to know.
It is Valentine's Day. In the spirit of love and relationships, I decided to watch a rom-com or romance. Upon arriving at the theater, our options were Anyone But You or Lisa Frankenstein. Frankenstein stars Catherine Newton, who you may know from Freaky or the Ant-Man series, and Cole Sprouse, who you may know from The Suite Life of Zack and Cody or The Suite Life on Deck. A movie about an angsty girl who falls in love with the reanimated corpse of a dead bachelor, Frankenstein seemed like a nice choice. And the trailer was so fun.
I tend to his grave.
I talk to him.
I wish I was with you.
That's really weird, Lisa.
I was planning on interviewing other moviegoers, but ultimately failed this very simple task. Sometimes movies make you pause and think a lot after watching them because of how good they are. This movie, instead, made me mute for an extended period of time following my viewing experience because of how much I did not enjoy it. I exited the theater in a trance, unable to track down potential interviewees. Lisa Frankenstein opens with The Promise by When in Rome, a song I absolutely love, and it stays faithful to its 80s theme through both soundtrack and style. Other notable mentions include Can't Fight This Feeling by REO Speedwagon, and Up the Down Escalator by The Chameleons. Usually, I like campy or so bad that it's good types of movies, but I felt like this one fell flat. I kept waiting for some sort of consistency in genre or humor or outrageousness. It was like Lisa Frankenstein couldn't decide what it wanted to be. But maybe this movie just isn't my type of thing. While Rotten Tomatoes gave it a 50%, the audience score was a solid 82%. Got me thinking about what really makes a movie bad. I definitely have some favorite films that other people probably hate.
Most recently, I watched Palm Springs, and I know that's like a really big hit amongst some people. I just think that I didn't really understand it. I wasn't really like captivated by it. I wasn't really like watching the whole time because it wasn't really like capturing my attention, I guess. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad movie. I just think it wasn't for me. I just don't think I understand why some people might like that movie.
Of course, my friend Eden, the first person I ask, says she hates one of my favorite movies.
Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, which I know is a bit controversial.
My friend Emily had some divisive opinions as well.
There's a lot of gore and like a lot of like shock factors to it. And I was like going into it like thinking, oh, it's a superhero movie. There's going to be a lot of action because I love action. But it was just a lot of, oof.
And now we're getting into interesting territory. You can still love a bad movie.
The Zoolander was a work of art. Not really. It was horrible. But it was good, though. I liked it. It was really bad to the point that it was good. And there was, like, two jokes and the plot made no sense. But it was good. I liked it.
As Ryan says, a multitude of factors can affect one's enjoyment of a film. Chloe and Emily agree.
I think that the people that you watch movies with and comment movies, like comment on movies with, are people that make the movie better. So who you're watching a movie with adds to the experience and takes a really terrible movie into a good one.
I don't watch that many movies. And when I do, most of the time I like enjoy it. I don't ever really think, oh, that was a bad movie.
I'm horrible as a movie critic because any movie that was entertaining to me, I just count as a good movie.
Thinking back on my initial reaction to Lisa Frankenstein, maybe the issue was just the conditions of when I watched the movie. Maybe I'd have liked it better if there were more people in the theater. Maybe I was tired that day or wore the wrong shirt. It's probably not that specific, but enough people liked the movie for it to have an audience rating of 82% on Rotten Tomatoes. So maybe I was wrong. Maybe you will love Lisa Frankenstein. You just have to figure out if it's bad enough to be good for you. For WNUR News, I'm Max Milo.
We might be headed into the holiday season, but some students and scientists celebrate another monthly occurrence, the tornado alarm test. Reporter Mika Ellison dives into the history and importance of the tornado sirens in Evanston and beyond.
It sounds like it comes from everywhere. You hear it if you're in class, walking on the sidewalk, or sitting inside with your window open. It sounds like the purge alarm, or if an ambulance siren was somehow massive and covered a mile radius.
Like, I remember being told about it freshman year, and people were... It was always like a big thing. They would bring it up and be like, oh, tornado siren, like this morning, don't freak out.
School of Comm senior Evan Trotter Wright spent 2 years hearing the alarms every first Tuesday of the month at 10 a.m. But unlike other Northwestern students, he has a unique way of interacting with them.
And last year was the first year I lived off campus, and I just like had the idea to like harmonize with it. And I did. I was walking like towards the rock through the arch, and there was like nobody around because it was like right at 10. And since then I've tried to get myself outside for every first Tuesday. I just think it's really funny.
The tornado alarms are an undeniable part of life in tornado country, which includes most of the middle of the country and can extend as far as Illinois and Alabama. But if you didn't grow up with them, they can come with a lot of questions.
And like, where are the speakers? Where does the sound come from? How is it so loud? How is it everywhere?
To answer some of these questions, and a few others, I spoke to meteorologist Harold Brooks about what tornado alarms are, how they fit into the emergency alert landscape, and where they come from.
Okay, so you've asked a ridiculously large question.
He told me it all started with one tornado from March 18th, 1925.
Tri-State tornado is a real watershed event in American consciousness about tornadoes.
The Tri-State tornado carved a deadly path across the U.S. from Missouri to Illinois and galvanized people enough that they started thinking about how to map and predict tornadoes. However, they would have to wait for a breakthrough in technology that didn't happen until 1948.
And on March the 20th of 1948, a tornado hits Tinker Air Force Base here in the Oklahoma City area. They have basically a brand new commander on the base, who comes to the meteorologists and basically says, you know, I'm not very happy that, you know, I had a bunch of planes get damaged. Your guy's job is to figure out how to tell me so that doesn't happen again. And he starts coming to daily weather briefings. And 5 days later, he's there and there. And these two guys are going, well, you know, it kind of looks a lot like last Thursday. And looking back at the weather maps, there was a genius level thought that these two events were similar. And basically the general said, well, why aren't you forecasting tornadoes then? He goes, well, nobody forecasts tornadoes. And the response from the commanding general of the base is, gentlemen, you're about to make history. And one of the guys who did the forecast said, I had gone home and just felt like, what a fool I've made of myself. Takes a nap, wakes up from the nap, and there's a news story about a tornado. And he's going, why are they talking about last week's tornado? And then he finds out it's actually happened again and hit the base again. So they got assigned then to start forecasting around the country for tornado threats.
Tornado alarms have grown with the latest technology of the day, piggybacking off of telegrams and telegraph networks to broadcast television and weather radios in the 1980s. Today, the tornado warning system runs out of a system of 120 local weather service offices. The Evanston one is in Romeoville, Illinois, that issue predictions for the day, tornado watch, tornado warnings, and the probability of other weather events like hail or high winds. But what about those tornado sirens? How do they fit into the landscape of emergency alerts? And how on earth did a massive system of outdoor sirens get built in the middle of America? It turns out the cause was something even more potentially dangerous than a natural disaster.
What grew out of civil defense for nuclear attack efforts. And that's part of where the sirens come from. You know, when they were originally intended, they were intended as the Russians have just launched an attack. And, you know, they didn't get used for that. Started in the Midwest in particular, we started using them as notifications.
Meteorologist Mackenzie Crochaw says that while tornado sirens may be the most visible or audible evidence of disaster warnings, they shouldn't, and usually aren't, the only way to learn about extreme weather.
They're a really important system because people do rely on them. You know, people kind of expect to hear them. But at least from the meteorology world, we really try to emphasize that you shouldn't be relying solely on these sirens because, you know, they are sometimes sounded manually. So someone has to actually go into an office or go to the siren and actually sound them. Some of them are automatic, but not all of them. And so there's just a wide variety in how they work and the policies that each city has to sound them. And so there's a little bit of a lack of consistency.
The tornado siren's locality is important. Cities each maintain and control their own systems, leading to sometimes confusing and sometimes hilarious regional differences.
And in Norman, we don't blow the sirens if it's a home football game for the University of Oklahoma because of visiting fans, not necessarily knowing what that is.
But there's a drawback to this locality. Tornado sirens are expensive to maintain, and cities are the ones who have to do the maintenance. Mobile, Alabama phased out their siren warnings a few years ago, and Harvard, Illinois eliminated theirs in 2019. Other towns followed suit, citing innovations like social media and the many ways people can get information about natural disasters now, along with high costs. When the city of Evanston replaced several sirens in 2019, the total cost was estimated to be over $100,000. But in natural disaster warnings, innovation and equity can be a matter of imminent life or death.
I think of it as a general ethics problem. Again, if a weak tornado is approaching a suburban area that has ordinarily well-built homes, worst possible thing that can happen is pretty close to nothing. Whereas that same tornado approaching an area in rural Alabama where there are a lot of mobile homes and a lot of other stuff, it might be a deadly event. Now, do we issue the same product for those two different populations?
Social media and television have become easy ways to communicate natural disaster warnings, but tornado sirens still serve a purpose for people who don't have the resources for a phone or a TV, or who are caught outside. A siren can be their only warning.
Most of the deaths, half the deaths in the U.S. occur in mobile homes, mobile and manufactured homes from tornadoes.
And if you don't know what the sirens or your emergency alerts mean, they won't be effective. Krochok also pointed out that research in emergency alerts often involves translation and communication.
Joseph Trujillo Falcon is really a pioneer in this space. And we've discovered that even some of the words that we're using to translate from English into Spanish do not resonate with people. And so, for example, we have a paper where we found that the term for a watch was actually indicating more urgency than the term for a warning. And that is not good. So we're doing quite a bit of linguistic work with partners who are in that space to try to understand how we can create meaningful translations.
No matter how good the science is, the ultimate test of natural disaster warnings goes back to the message of the tri-state tornado. How many people can we save?
And the field has definitely moved into a space where we are now recognizing that we can have a perfect forecast, but if it's not meaningful to people, then it's not going to be useful. And so working really, really hard to make sure that our products and services that come from NOAA and the National Weather Service are accurate, of course, but also meaningful and useful, and that our forecasts are in spaces where people are looking for that information.
Emergency alert systems can sometimes feel like preparing for a disaster that will never actually happen. But Brooks ended with a story that demonstrated just how valuable a system that works is. It was May 20th, 2013, and the Norman Regional Hospital System had an hour and a half advance notice before a destructive tornado would hit.
They had an incredible system. I mean, it's one of those, I wouldn't have noticed it, but you know, when they described it, it was brilliant. It was like they had little sticky dots, red, yellow, or green, outside of every room. The kind of thing you wouldn't really even notice, but all of their staff knew that green meant these were the safest locations in the hospital in case of a tornado. Yellow were, and red, where we really don't want people in these rooms. And so even the custodial staff knew. And when they put out their, we're putting in tornado procedures, if they saw someone who was not in a green area, they were to direct them into the green area.
In the short amount of time they had, the staff of the hospital moved nearly every patient into safe areas.
And they got down to where they had one patient that they couldn't move. They had moved everybody out of patient rooms that weren't green. And the only person who didn't move was a woman who was going into labor. And they took the mattresses from all the adjoining rooms and put them around all of the windows in her room and made her room a little cocoon. And she gave birth right about the time the tornado hit the hospital. There's no sun up
in the sky, stormy weather.
Maybe you hate being woken up by the blaring sirens once a month. Maybe you hum along. Maybe you've had no idea what they meant until now. Whatever rings true for you, organizations like NOAA and the National Weather Service will continue to develop, improve, and inform about the tornado alarms, so that no matter who you are or where you are, you'll be able to stay safe. For WNUR News, I'm Mika Ellison.
It's Monday, meaning it's time to tune in to the B-List. Ella Smith has the scoop on the latest goings-on in sports and arts and entertainment.
Welcome to the B-List, your weekly roundup of celebrity mess and pop culture. This week, a wrap on the MLB postseason, new Tyler the Creator, pre-election appearances, and more. In sports, the Los Angeles Dodgers claimed their 8th World Series title on Wednesday after winning 7-6 against the New York Yankees in the 5th game. In television, for the last SNL episode before the election, Vice President and Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris made an appearance on the show. Hosted by comedian John Mulaney and musician Chappell Roan, Harris showed up along her longtime impersonator, comedian Maya Rudolph. In the sketch, the two spoke to each other through a mirror about the upcoming election. In music, Tyler, the Creator, released his 8th studio album, Chromacopia, on Monday. The album debuted at the top of the Billboard charts with almost 300,000 units sold in the U.S., a personal record for the artist and the 6th best debut of the year. Chromacopia has also received good reviews, receiving a 7.6 out of 10 on Pitchfork and 4 stars by Rolling Stone. Tyler, the Creator, promoted his album this week with surprise performances in Boston and New York City. The music industry also mourns the loss of Quincy Jones, a legendary producer. Jones, known for producing Michael Jackson's Thriller and Bad, and co-producing the famous charity song We Are the World, was 91 years old. He is credited for working on almost 400 albums and composing over 30 films, such as The Color Purple and The Wiz. In movies, Venom: The Last Dance tops the box office for a second week, making over $300 million globally. The Wild Robot continues to stay strong in its 6 weeks in theaters and placed second after Venom, raking in $7.6 million last week. That's all for the B-List this week. Check in next Monday to hear about what happens this week in pop culture. For WNUR News, I'm Ella Smith.
Taking a look into the headlines. On the Northwestern campus, the field hockey team has secured an undefeated regular season record with a win over Ohio State. This is the first ever undefeated season for Tracy Fuchs and company, and they will be headed to the NCAA tournament next. Those who frequent the Purple Line in Evanston will have some detours this weekend. The line will be shut down from Linden to Howard starting at 5 a.m. on Saturday until 2 a.m. on Monday. On a state and national scope, what else is there to discuss but the U.S. election? Citizens around the nation are gearing up to vote tomorrow, and many have voted early. In Illinois, there are also 3 advisory questions on the ballot: harassment against election workers, a 3% income tax on gains over $1 million, and assisted reproductive health coverage for insurance plans. In the island nation of Mauritius, social media access has been banned. This comes just 1 week before their parliamentary elections and on the back of a scandal where politician conversations were leaked on social media. That's all for WNUR News at 6 p.m. For more news updates and reports, follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at WNUR News. You can listen to these and other WNUR News stories on our website, WNURnews.org. That's WNURnews.org. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Our producers today are Edward Simon Cruz and Krishna Kumar, and our reporters are Ingrid Smith, Max Milo, Mika Ellison, and Ella Smith. From all of us here at WNUR News, thanks for listening. I'm Gabe Shumway. Catch our next newscast on Wednesday, November 6th at 6 p.m. Now, back to scheduled programming.